I'll make you ride a moon.
All right. Good morning and welcome to all of you. We have one apology from Professor Nalan Lava. Professor Nalan Lava is PPC.
Can I just, I think
some scattered supplement would be useful. But as far as the process,
yes.
You know, so we've only had one submission. We've still got to go through the course by clause and the things I'm sure that you know, members will pick up. I think that I would like, and I mean, as far as the print in the EGE report, I did notice a lot of it was, you know, there were these quite broad assertions of unlawfulness and unconstitutionality, and presumably that is the CGE's view. But also just to give clarity, I mean, who is this exactly from, the submission? Is it from the CGA and CGE as a commission? As it's issued by their parliamentary office. So I just wanted to know, is it from the parliamentary office or is it from the commission as a whole?
Well, none of it really matters. These are commission's letter in the logo, so...
Yeah, but you see, it's drafted by the parliamentary office. It's signature by the chairperson or whatever. But anyway, we can just take note of that. I mean, a lot of the points are still, I think, very good.
Sure. And, you know, at your leisure, Mr. Lubscotty, you can respond to what is in this submission. But let's go through what you have placed before us and proceed from there. All right?
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I want to apologize for only distributing the document now, but I've been working on it. I only finished it about 9 o'clock this morning, so that's why there wasn't time to submit it to the secretary prior to this meeting. Chairperson, it will be difficult. I can't take the committee to this document, rules by clause. What I've done is, as I said, I used the present act as the basis,
mm-hmm.
and then what we have deleted from the present act are indicated by means of brackets, and the insertions are done by means of underlining the way that we normally do, amending legislation. I can't take the committee to this thing or to this document, but I think once we get to the, once the committee gets to the clause by clause analysis, then actually at that stage, this document, in my view, will be much more useful than giving the committee now a broad overview of what we intend to do. Because in my briefing to the committee previously, I highlighted the main clauses, the main that we intend to address in the bill. It's basically related to functioning and the composition of the commission. But let me quickly take a minute to this document, unless you have any other suggestions or questions.
Yeah, I would sort of rather, if you're going to start going through clause by clause, then let's start going through clause by clause.
Okay.
And then at the start, there can be an input from Lubscotty or department to say, okay, this is why we do it, this is new or not new. But I don't think you should run through the documents now. Let's start.
Okay. Yeah, let's rather do that.
The committee members look at the document that I distributed this morning. First of all, on page 2, we change the long title of the existing act to say that the purpose of the bill is to provide for the composition, powers, functions, and functioning of the South African. Of course, the name of the commission has been changed in the constitution from the Human Commission to the South African Human Rights Commission. So that's why we inserted the South African there. And then we did read the whole existing preamble, because that preamble refers to the 1993 constitution, which has been repealed, and we then suggest that it be replaced with our new preamble, which refers basically to the new constitution, and as well as the powers and functions of the Minas Commission as provided for in the constitution. We have also think to align powers and functions of the different chapter 9 institutions, try to from other acts or founding legislation of chapter 9 look at the powers and functions of those commissions and then sort of include it in this law. In other words, to broaden the powers functions of the commission.
What's the point of the preamble? All the preamble is doing is repeating the constitution. Nothing else.
It's coming out
to you. No. I mean,
in the bill.
I'm looking at the introduced bill, but in terms of whichever document we've got. On the starting document now, it's the underlying section at the bottom. But either way, the preamble just repeats the constitution. What's the point?
But what is offering convention, Chair? Because, I mean, we have now adopted some new, haven't we? There was a time we didn't put in repetitive whereases from the constitution, then there was a time we did, I must remember. But what is our convention now?
But I mean, but usually the preamble will give a background why you got this bill. But it will usually say more than just the constitution. And here we've got a bill whose preamble is just reference to the constitution. So I'm really asking what's coming to nothing. I can't find anything different. So it's a question of what's the point of the thing.
And one thing that's worth saying, perhaps, is that the constitution any other powers would be recorded in a statute. So it might be worth pointing to that if you find it not a statute.
What's the point of the preamble?
So, listen, I do to some extent agree with Mr. Devery, but I think the preamble goes a bit further than what is stated in the constitution itself. And purpose is to sort of give, as Mr. Devery said, to give the reason for the bill. And I think, although we did not repeated the wording in the constitution, I think that the preamble goes a bit further. But I assume the committee is not going to vote on the bill today, and that the committee will still the committee will still have time to consider these kind of issues. But personally, I think that lately it's the thing to include preambles in new bills, as Mr. Jeffrey said, to sort of give an explanation of motivation for the bill. But if the committee feels that this preamble is merely a repetition of the existing provisions of the Constitution, then the committee needs to give me guidance on the matter. And as far as the whereas is concerned, I've noted that during my meeting previously, so I will definitely address that issue once we start to prepare amendments to the law.
All right. Mr. Jeffrey, then Mr.
Look, maybe a preamble which does say where this comes from, and the much shorter one, because effectively what you've done here is you've taken 184 and you've sort of rewritten it a bit. But I don't see anything new. I mean, what you've done is you know, your legalistic one is 181.1b, which makes reference to human rights commissions, and then 184 is with item 20 of Schedule 6. I haven't looked up those yet. Provide for this well, that it continues to function. Yes, but I think it could be shorter, because then under your second whereas, you're dealing there with 184.1, which is promote, and monitor, and then you've taken under the annually, that's 184.3, and then your last whereas is 184.2 and 184.4. So all you've done really effectively is repeated 184. I would have put a shorter preamble, which basically says no whereases, because who uses whereas anymore, apart from what you call a meat and smuts.
Not them all.
But basically, you know, that the preamble, that in terms of sections, whatever the constitution, the Human Rights Commission, the national legislation is provided for its additional powers and functions or whatever, the reason. Why repeat 184? I don't know, that would just be my, off the top of my head view, I don't know what other colleagues' views are.
Just chop out the second paragraph,
you
take out the second word.
Yes. Well, I think, not that I'm one who prefer simplicity in terms of legislation, but that is an ordinary person. And that's even at the sense what the law is about. So I don't have any problem with the preamble stating the origin of the deed, the constitution. Rather than have to spend the going looking around for the constitution, it's easier for the unfortunate person to look and see what the bill is about. But I think we need to be consistent, as you, as I think things have asked before. What has been our position regarding the preamble? So we outline what the statute is already contained in some other legislation, but we know that let's have a statute. But if it doesn't offend anything, in that regard, to consider, I believe that it's useful for the government looking at the human rights.
I have a suggestion that it be made a little more succinct.
I would have used that.
Okay. Anyone else? No.
Okay. So can I then accept that as a request from the
yes.
From the team? So I need to make notes for all of us. I'm going to get
that's fine.
Listen, then we go to and again that wording Parliament of the Republic of South Africa therefore in acts will be amended. I know that was the way that the previous committee deferred it to be so often, but clearly this committee has a different view, so I will also then look at that issue. If we then get to clause 1, the clause that inserts definitions in the actual person, I'm only going to highlight the new definitions, because otherwise if I have to explain each and every amendment, then it will take us a few days. In view of a new clause that has been inserted in the bill, deemed necessary to include the definition of chief executive officer. The existing act do not have a definition of constitution, so we include a definition of the constitution, and then at present the present act do not provide for a deputy chairperson. So we have inserted a few clauses that provide or deal with powers and functions of the deputy chairperson, so we deem it necessary to include the definition of deputy chairperson. And then another issue that was raised during my briefing is the difference between fundamental rights and human rights. And again, it's a pity that the Human Rights Commission is not present to sort of explain the difference between fundamental and human rights. That was a proposal made by them, made by the Commission. I think in the documentation that was submitted to the department, they explained why they want it to change from fundamental to human rights, but not being a human rights expert, I must admit, but I don't know the difference. Then, again, as a result of some of the...
One more. We're not going to discuss this point.
But we should.
And I'm a human rights off on it.
I mean, my... I mean, fundamental human rights are obviously narrower than human rights. But when there's a reference to that too, those are the rights we're speaking about. So I don't think it matters whether you say they're fundamental or whether they're human. It's right in refer to chapter 2. My concern, and it was raised in the briefing, is the new section that you've added in of relevant international and regional human rights instruments, which is an addition in that... Well, what's the definition of that? In what is the relevance of national or regional human rights instruments? What happens if we haven't ratified it yet? So I think that clause is quite problematic. So, I think that I don't know how much Mr. Labuschagne can respond to because he's not the commissioner. I don't know how much Ms. Cohen can respond to. But if she can't respond now, if she can then come back to us on this point. But I think for me it's the thing. I think that human rights is, human rights includes the human rights contained in chapter 2 of the Constitution. Full stop.
Yeah. But what Mr. Labuschagne perhaps usefully could do is point us to any provisions in this amending bill which would be relevant to the relevant international and regional human rights instrument, that we can see where this could go. Because in as much as it may constitute an expansion of the constitutional functions of the UTSN within the country. And I mean, if you want to wander off into the international terrain, then I mean, what happens at the customary international law? You don't want to start fooling around with relevance, which nobody knows what is relevant and what isn't. Can just create a difficulty. But can the discussion point us to a clause in the bill which needs this broader definition and upon which this broader definition will have impact?
I don't say if there's a need for a reference to international and international human rights instruments, to say applicable instead of relevant. I mean, they have been ratified and so on, adopted as part of all of
them. Thanks, Chair. I also wanted to follow up on the question of relevant international and regional human rights issues. Relevant is that it is important to actually do that. But I think maybe indicating that the Colonisa is indicating that it should be applicable international and regional human rights instruments. Maybe to some extent also maybe include sub-regional because so it actually also operates as country sub-regional. And there have been a number of instruments, sub-regional human rights instruments.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether making relevant applicable does solve it. But the objects of the commission are all about promotion. think we need to be looking at the sea, monitoring and assessing the observance of rats in chapter 2. Let's get that right, rather than looking at international treaties that we may or may not have ratified.
Saying the word road must come out.
Well, we were proposing it come out, because Mother Scruffy can look, and if he feels it was a strong argument, that you can come up with it, then you come back and tell us later, and think he was fine, and it was a compelling argument.
All right. Okay, Mr. Webster. Let's move on.
Maybe I'm going to survive this.
I guarantee you, there's no way I can do this.
He just learned to know.
As I mentioned,
when
I started the
alright, let that be the last one, Mr. Swan.
I'm glad Mr. Jerry picked this one up because, as I initially said, I'm not going to go into each and every small amendment. So that will take us then a few days to go through this document. So I'm pretty basically highlighting the new changes.
Yes.
We've inserted the definition of Public Finance Management Act because we have included a provision providing for the appointment of the Chief Executive Officer who has to perform certain duties in terms of the, let's call it PMA. That's why it was instead of every time repeating the old long title, also title to include the definition. And then we also included the definition of warrant, which is a major issue. Chairperson, then clause 2, the office of the commission, if my memory serves me well, I think that is basically almost a repetition of the constitution, just repeated it, chapter 9, but it was deemed necessary that despite the fact that it's already provided for in the constitution that we should repeat it here, because it's always difficult to read two documents together, so rather keep it together. Otherwise, you have to take the constitution, you have to take this bill and read them. And I know it's not used to constitutional reasons.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with Mr. Lavka. But the only problem I've got to with is 2C. That makes reference to monitor and assess the observance of human rights in the Republic. I feel that there's a component that's very important on your part, that you are on the part of the South African Institution, Human Rights Commission, has not been included. And that's compliance. It's not the constitution, but it's about implementing the act that actually helps you implement the constitution. And there's no compliance, money to comply, compliance with human rights in the Republic.
Let me hear you on this point and any others, Mr. Alameza and then Mr. Jeffrey.
Yes, Chair. Always on what Mr. Jeffrey has said, I'm reminded of the new project of the Auditor General, where the Auditor General discovered that there's certain transgressions that were committed, and yet the review was continued on around, nothing happening. So indeed, I think there's a need for some power to be given to the Commission to do something for those who haven't been observed to fail to respect human rights and something we've done. Just to monitor them, and then why didn't we observe that there is nothing happening?
Yes, we observed.
I would have thought one of the things I need to do would be to what happened then.
Mr. Jeffrey and then Mr. Smuts.
Look, this is the object clause. It's like broad. And I think it's appropriate that it's these categories taken from the Constitution. The additional detail then should go under the powers and functions. And I note that they have put in a new one of under clause 14, monitoring the implementation of and compliance with international media regional conventions or treaties, covenants, charters. So I see it there, and I would really suggest that it does belong under a power, not as an object. The power is the detail, the object is the broader aspect. So I'm not respectfully in agreement with my colleague, I think let's keep the objects as broad. I think it's appropriate that they then take from what is the constitution, and then under the powers we deal more with specific actions that the commission is meant to do, things the commission is meant to do. So I'm in agreement with it as it is.
All right, but we need to look very carefully at 14 if we go that route. I'm not convinced, but it's there.
No, what I'm saying is we can add more to 14.
Sure.
But really what I'm saying is I'm not saying I agree with 14 as it is, but I'm agreeing with the principle of keeping objects
as it is,
simple as they are, preferably taking the Constitution, and then the detail, and we can add more, put it under the power section under 14.
Fair enough. Smuts?
Chairman, I have to say that I'm completely opposed to introducing the concept of compliance. Do not forget that the Chapter 9 are not courts of law. I repeat, they are not courts of law. And the job of this particular Chapter 9, in other words, they do not make rulings. Their opinions are not enforceable. Their efficacy rests on their moral persuasion. While the previous Human Rights Commission, and this one is getting there, when it develops authority, that is when it utters on a subject, people accept that. But these are not, nor should they be, bodies that can make enforceable decisions. The Chapter 2, the Constitution is not self-executing. You don't break Chapter 2. The fundamental human rights are given effect to in laws, or in judgment law in the courts. And when you transgress one of those laws, the use of investigative procedures and other procedures will follow. But these bodies are not and should not be tribunals. They do not sit in judgment. They make a finding up to a certain point that then goes to the relevant authority that does carry such power. And for my taste, the word compliance is okay in 14, as it has just been read, because there we are talking about compliance with international treaties and other instruments, and compliance in that respect means simply that you report every year or every 10 years on what you as a country have done to implement any particular treaty, the socio-economic one that we're about to ratify, the ICCPR, etc. That is the compliance which we have failed so spectacularly to perform, and which, thanks to the Human Rights Commission, we now are beginning to perform better on. We are beginning to write the reports, get them to the United Nations. That's the kind of compliance the Human Rights Commission can look after.
You want to have another book? Do you want to have
somehow it's heavy on my heart when we don't want to actually put it into because mainly the work of the South African Human Rights Commission is really to monitor compliance, be it national, tribunal, regional, or international. And to just say we will find it under powers, I feel as if we don't use something that is actually what is core business of the Human Rights Commission enough attention when it comes to objects. Because we actually put taking from the Constitution the way it has actually been outlined, but the fact of the matter is that it's just a broad statement and it doesn't actually clearly articulate what the South African Human Rights Commission is really supposed to do in terms of human rights in South Africa. Observing and seeing is clearly okay.
Indeed, what's the point of monitoring and assessing if you're not going to ensure compliance? If that is the objective of the Commission, to ensure compliance. Or is that very common for you? Observing.
I mean, this is what the Constitution asks.
But the content is that the Commission must have teeth of some kind.
No, these are not bodies of teeth.
Don't mind us.
That's very efficient watch dogs in Brazil when they are themselves efficient. But chapter 9 does not invisit bodies that sit as tribunals. It simply does not. And so, for example, when under those socioeconomic provisions that are in the final constitution, when they subpoena government departments, especially the Republican ones, to come and report on what they've done about progressive realization of the socioeconomic rights, their reports, the Human Rights Commission's reports, should expose departments that haven't done enough about water, housing, etc. And those reports come to Parliament, and Parliament is supposed to do something about it. That is their function in life. They're not tribunals. They don't hand down punishments, etc.
And I do agree, Chair. They're not tribunals, and they have to submit those reports. So they can only do them if they have a sole responsibility. I'm actually going back to the point that I made earlier about compliance, that feels like by not including it, really not something that about intrinsic business of the South African Human Rights Commission.
I'm not sure if we're talking about compliance with international treaties or compliance with human rights.
For now, my concern is actually on the object space of saving human rights. The observance, whether South Africa really observes human rights. Now, my colleague is about to say, monitoring, compliance of human rights, South Africa and business of South Africa and the laws of South Africa to be such that they actually manage to protect the rights of the people of South Africa. So we monitor that kind of compliance. And at the national level, then we go to, if we have notified the regional and international people, then we actually do that.
When you say you're observing this, it doesn't end with your watching it, looking at it. It goes beyond that. The word observe actually goes, and perhaps we need to look at that.
It's not unlike compliance.
Yes, that's the point I'm trying to make. But first, Mr. Jeffrey, and then Mr. Smith.
I mean, it's monitor and assess the observance. so it's the problem with compliance is going to be, I don't think we want the Human Rights Commission to tell Parliament that our laws are not compliant. That's not their market. And if you start saying, giving that power, then that's what could happen. Similarly with, I mean, as has been said with SFAR's compliance, they're a watchdog. They don't necessarily, watchdogs in this case don't necessarily have teeth, but should have a loud bark. But you need to be careful about the fact that you can't have, if you're going to have them making decisions that have implications, then you're going to have a whole lot of due process thrown in as well. So, for example, they have made the Human Rights Commission findings of human rights violations. They made a finding, I think, that the Minister of Police is taking on review on that jogger. Is that not the case? And they made a finding, as came out in our budget hearing, on the Tatai matter that undue force was used. And they're entitled to make those findings, but you can't appeal those findings. You can only take on review because they're not a tribunal. And I think the minister in the case of the jogger is taking that one on review. But I think you know the purpose of those findings is to basically alert the public that this Chapter 9 body to protect our rights is saying that there's something wrong here. It can't be enforceable. Once it becomes enforceable, then it's a whole new ballgame. And it's the same with the public protector. She is not enforceable. What she says is not enforceable. It's a watchdog with a loud bark.
And
it gets headed
on.
And even with the Auditor General.
I think at some point, this is a point we need to try and find agreement amongst ourselves as committee members.
I don't know what the Constitution tells you. I mean, I'm sure the Constitution does not give them enforceable powers. In each case, it says what they do. The IEC manages the election.
Okay.
And then it's statute does various other things. ICOSA is an unusual, it's a regulator.
Well, that's different.
The only one that has actual power.
They're a regulator.
But the commission,
yeah.
The gender, the human rights, the cultural and religion, they are not tribunals, nor would they to be. And everything you're discussing now comes down to an amendment to the Constitution,
yeah.
For which I am not too proud.
Right, Mr. Jeffrey, I'm sorry
I managed to be covered, but it was I mean, maybe this thing could stand over, I think, the discussion from the U.S. rather than trying to conclude it. But I do think we need to be clear of what the Human Rights Commission's function is and the dangers of when you start giving when the implication of that.
Right, Mr. Simagnoni, followed by Ms. Chobisky.
Unfortunately, Mr. Jeff has put in my thumb the workshop of a human rights security they are there to ensure that the abuse of human rights will never happen. Now we've got to decide to what extent do they make sure that the abuse of human rights will never happen. So in the assessment to a certain extent, there should be some mechanisms or some people even with the analog of the workshop to put into place that this will happen.
I when Dean spoke, I had this picture of this bulldog whipping out its false teeth and giving us the big grin with its gums. But that's just by way of
with respect, that's what your constitution has created.
I
always think of the imagery of the teeth that people use is unfortunate, you know. It is about barking, and you know, they're as good as the people that we have put onto them.
That's right.
Yeah.
Ms. Shelston.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to support my comrade Dean Smart. I think he's 100% right. You know, the way she analyzes it, the way I can understand it as, you know, I'm not a legal person, you're speaking about my head, but when she analyzes it, I think she's correct. Because I think about the Auditor General, that's the line that I understand. The Auditor General makes a finding and he recommends. It's very clear. You'll always get in the report of the Auditor General, these things are wrong, these things could be done better, then recommendations. And he comes to report to Parliament, to SCOGA, and to the committee on the standing committee or the Auditor General, that this is what should be done if the situation can change. He never passes judgment.
And
he is quite effective. Mm-hmm. And we take him very seriously. And nobody makes a mistake. We are all clear on what he has said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other Chapter 9 institutions should actually do it that way. Thank you very much, Dean. You know, I didn't understand what these people are talking about. You made it simple for me as a rural person.
Well, I tend to think they do live in fear of his reports.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, I misunderstood. My apologies.
I think we all agree that they have to write reports. The point that was made was the whole issue of really improving compliance, that they should monitor compliance. And that compliance process would then end up in reports that come to Parliament. Do you agree with that?
but it already happened.
Yes, yes. Our reaction makes a reference to the amendment of Clause 2 that is for to do with objects to say that compliance is not there, that we can see how relevant it is. And not to say that we are actually going to become a tribunal when you put it. They're not going to become a tribunal, but when compliance is there, almost it actually then takes into their mandate that has got to do with power. To then say that whatever their responsibility is about, it's really to monitor compliance with human rights issues and international regulations.
Okay.
Not about the tribunal. They're not becoming a tribunal. They will tell us they will come to Parliament. The Parliament then has to make all those reports.
Mrs. Schaefer, Mr. Swart, and Mr. Hamid, saying that one of you.
Mr. Chair, apologies for being late. In terms of the way it's worded in the Constitution, I don't think it's for us now to check. I mean, this is, as far as I understand, a reflection of exactly how it's worded in the Constitution. We can't give them something that they don't have there.
So, very briefly, it's clearly not a tribunal. If one looks at 14 sub 9, that the Commission may bring proceedings in a competent court or tribunal in its own name. That's the key. It makes recommendations. If it wants to take it further, then it can enforce it in a court of law or a tribunal. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Ms. Solomon, sir. 14.1b9. I think it did fail the process.
It does fail?
Yeah, because if they take proceedings against the data, human rights standards, but ensuring that they're compliant. Data is that let us look at the chapter at the clause dealing with power and the proposition.
All right. Okay, I think this is an interesting discussion. We've broadened it somewhat, Mr. Lavasathani. I think you might probably realize because we weren't just looking at this commission but the other chapter and how we see their powers. So essentially, then, Mr. Lavasathani is looking at any question. What is in clause 2 remains there, right? Okay.
Chairperson, then clause 3 deals with the seat of the commission. Only by the technical amendments, the words duties and have been deleted because the view has been expressed that functions also include duties.
Okay.
And that has been done throughout the board.
I can see that the 3-2 we give them the power to establish these offices, but is it any more necessary for the president in one to determine the seat? Or should that be kept forever? I mean, the seat is now established in Joburg.
And if it's moved?
Must it be the president? Or should we leave it to the commission since they already established offices?
And if they choose to move it to Kugla?
Well, you say that now.
All right, Mr. Jeffrey.
I would rather see somebody else being responsible for the seat.
Who?
Well, it would then have to be the president. I mean, I don't think it's you know, in terms of bodies over the commission, it's either Parliament or the National Assembly or the president as the appointing authority. I would rather, but I don't think it should be left to them. I don't know. I mean, Gender Commission, is their head office in Cape Town? Because I see from there, the letter in the commission,
yes.
The address at the bottom is Adley Street. That's the building. I don't know if that's the head office or whether it's elsewhere. Is it? Okay. But I don't think the Act should say where it is specifically. But I would suggest we leave it as the president, not give it up to the commission, but not put it into the Act.
So I'm happy with 3 as it is.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Alvisa. Yeah, in that clause
2.
I see.
Daphne explained previously that functions, duties only go with functions, functions and duties. And functions are contained in 14 powers, functions, and it's assumed that includes duties. That's the explanation.
There's not in any event even if that was in duty and function.
Duty is something you've got to do.
Function is.
Function would be the broad things you do, but the duty would be the specific you've got to do if you don't go.
Yeah, every Friday we're sending goal.
Reasonably to end, probably, yeah.
I think function is broader than duty.
Function is broader, but a duty is compulsory, it's obligatory. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah.
Listen, yes, if you see it acted at present, the voice for those duties and functions, the words duties and was deleted on the advice of the state law advisors. They are present, maybe they can give the committee some more detail on that issue if the committee so desires.
Yeah, but it seems to be quite common to find duties and functions in the number of people in this case.
But just before the state law advisors, I know the Constitution doesn't refer to duties. So it would be the South African Human Rights Commission has the powers of regulating by national legislation necessary to perform its functions, including the power, and then it goes on. The Human Rights Commission has additional powers and functions prescribed by national legislation. There's no reference to duties that I can find here.
Okay. Thank you, President. Chair, what if so in other legislation you will find powers, duties, and functions? But on further examinations, we would feel that powers, or rather, our understanding is that the powers may include duties that a person may or may have to perform. That's why, sir, we feel that powers and functions, as they stand in this particular sub-clause, sir, don't take anything away, sir, if we remove the duties. But ultimately, the person will be able to perform, to exercise the powers and perform the functions. Therefore, the removal of the word duties, Chair, does not take anything away, Chair, from the meaning of the sub-clause, because the powers would include duties that the person will have to perform or be assigned in terms of the Constitution, Chair.
What is just read by JJ, it seems as if in the Constitution it talks about duties. It doesn't. I thought you mentioned duties.
No.
That's my point. But my concern is if you look at 184.4, the Human Rights Commission has additional powers and functions prescribed by national legislation. Should 3.2 not refer to powers and functions? Should that not be the wording? So rather duties and functions, because duty is not in the Constitution. The Constitution talks about powers and functions. And it talks specifically about legislation prescribing that. So if the legislation says the Commission must do A, B, C, D, E, and then in order to do that you need an office somewhere in Parkamas, and therefore you can open that office. So the suggestion here would be that under 2, we do need the deletion of duties and we do delete duties, but we include power, and it then be for its powers and functions.
Exercise
the powers. Oh, okay, no, they're already going right. Okay, no, I forgot that.
All right, I was beginning to wonder. Thank
you, Chairperson. Because we're dealing with human rights, I've just made an observation that our visitors are not eating anything. And we just...
Which human rights?
They're right to food. They're
right to food.
They don't eat any wheat, drink, and tea. They're not aware that we do have beer.
Oh, all right. Can I, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, beverages and snacks are outside. please, without disturbing the meeting.
It's the right of access to sufficient
resources. You're welcome. You're welcome to go out and help yourselves. I thought that was understood in our committee meetings, by the way. I'm required to announce.
Can
you
just
note
that the
Miss Curran
seems to be exercising her life?
I thought she would have told everyone else. Or texted them.
What do we call it? What about the Miss Olympic stuff? He's not getting up
there. Well, that's his duty. Well, I know it's not in the Constitution. Alright, so it stayed as it is then? Alright.
Well, listen, then if we get to feel support that's dealing with the independence and impartiality of the commission, you'll know that the new term of one is inserted, which is intended to make it clear that the commission is independent. I think Ms. Smart said, you know, that the briefing indicated that is from the Constitution is already clear. So I got the impression that she sort of questioned the necessity of this paragraph.
You mean 4.1a? I'm questioning.
Look, the Constitution says 181.2, and it's with particular reference to current issues with other chapter 9. Independent and subject only to the Constitution and law. Okay. And then under Constitution you've got then 181.5, which accounts for the National Assembly and its report on its activities. My fear in terms of just by saying the Commission is independent is that you remove that section about subject only to the Constitution and the law.
Yeah.
The Commission could then say, well, you know, with the Act says we're independent, so 181.5 shouldn't interfere. So I don't see the point of this. It's in the Constitution, and it's clearly put in the Constitution.
In the grandest terms conceivable, but with the exception of
the... So you're saying A should be removed.
Did I say that before? I come back here.
All right. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Except there's no problem with our removing A. But, sir, what we should also note is that we are all always subject to the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, sir. Even if that A is not removed, but no problem with it being removed, but we are all subject to the Constitution. That's what we say.
No, we hear you, and we agree with you. We agree with you 100%. But of late, we've had people making their own interpretations of what is both in the Constitution and the law. And we're having enormous problems with it. So where we can, let's not create any unnecessary ambiguity. So A comes out.
Chairperson B, in B, we have inserted a new subparagraph 1, subparagraph 2 and 3, which basically will provide that a member of the commission or a member of staff commission may not use the position or privileges of a given member of staff for private gain or may not act in a manner that compromises the credibility, impartiality, independence or integrity of the commission. And then another new clause that we have said that is subclause 2, where we provide provision is made that all goods of state must afford the commission such assistance as may be reasonably required for the protection of independence, impartiality, blah blah blah, in pursuit of its objects. Further on, it's basically
that's the gender commission's first point.
Yes.
It goes to the teeth issue.
They're objecting to that.
Well, they're basically saying that it's meaningless and it's toothless. And they want a penalty. I'm just raising that as something to look at. This is on page 2 of the Gender Commission report. The Gender Commission looks like this, on page 2. And they're basically saying that
TDU's concerned with the construction of subclause 4.2 because of operation and assistance is denied in critical matters such as investigations which compromise the independence, dignity and persistence of most Chapter 9 institutions, including the Human Rights Commission. In many cases, such conduct is executed deliberately and with impunity because no effective remedy exists. So they don't support because it serves no purpose. They want a penalty clause. I'm just grading that to highlight. You know, again, with reference to other, I suppose a penalty clause would have to be a court to determine, if you say it's an offence to, the suggestion of willful contravention is an offence, that would have to be determined by a court. So, you know, the other would be reporting Parliament. I mean, I understand what they're saying around the heat issue. I don't know whether one is putting this Cohen through chair in the spot, but I mean, she has been there for some time in the commission. I mean, I don't know what she thinks of this thing, because you do want them to be able to get cooperation, and I'm sure it's been incredibly frustrating when they write to an organ state for assistance. But then also remembering that the commission is investigating everybody. It's not a government investigating body like the public protector. There would be, you know, so the private sector. Yeah, but I hear what they're saying. I'm not sure if it needs to be penalised or whether it should be maybe reported to the National Assembly if they're not getting support. Yeah.
Mr. Schaefer and then Smith.
Yeah, there is an offences penalties clause.
Right.
Maybe we should look at including it there somehow. If we want to
say
it.
Do we want to be penalised?
Yeah.
Do we want that?
Yeah.
Well, Smith?
Okay, so this kept coming up, even under the Philippines, Human Rights Commission. A government department who has not just statutory but constitutional duty, someone report to the commission on the progressive realization of the socioeconomic crisis. Many of those specific departments simply never responded to the commission. And therefore, reluctantly and at long last, that SAHRC started issuing subpoenas. The thing that they do have is the right to subpoena. Now, that's quite a big deal, to subpoena a minister. And then so they secure their attendance eventually by this means. But I think that it's a misconstruction of what the Chapter 9s are to start creating penalties. It's like you don't want an independent institution now running for court because a government department isn't reporting to them. It's all wrong. There are some things in life that have to be sorted politically. Like the whole question of accountability and ministerial responsibility. You know, if a parliament and if politicians can't sort certain things, you can't come to the court with absolutely every damn thing. I mean, there is supposed to be such a thing as the power that we hold as a legislator, the power that the executive holds as an executive, and you don't start writing offences and penalties for everything in sight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some things have to be sorted politically.
Right.
No, just I see that the 4.3 is an offence, which is interfering, hindering, or obstructing the commission. That is something more serious. So basically, following on from the SMUT, I would say that these things as they are in the bill, this requirement about supporting assistance, and then criminalisation is only the interference or hindering.
Going back to compliance, I think if you have to monitor compliance, then there's no sanctions. You're wasting your time. There will be report after report after report and nothing happening. So there's got to be a way, maybe we shouldn't say penalty, it sounds a bit harsh. Maybe say sanction. And then at the end of that, well, I'm going to say maybe because of the sound of penalty. And then at the end of that, clause 23 on fairness and penalty, it talks about fines. I mean, if you look at the competition authority or commission,
mm-hmm.
it becomes effective because of the kind of fines that it imposes.
But that's not a Chapter 9 institution.
Yeah.
That's not a Chapter 9 institution. So we're talking about
the court and the
business. Yes. And they it's available.
And their funds are of the order of giving a turnover.
Yes, well, so okay, that's the formula they use. But the point that I'm making, maybe I gave a bad example. The point that I'm making is that when you're monitoring compliance of something, and you monitor, and when it's not happening, there's no way of actually really managing to get some form of details. It becomes a problem, because you're going to enter into exercises.
It's not the same.
No, it's really the auditor general actually monitoring how the money has actually been utilized, as you've got the money. Here it's about just human rights, observance of human rights,
what?
Compliance to human rights requirements. Otherwise, you're going to find that there's no rule of law and because of the
No.
I've got the following names. This is an important discussion, and I'm glad it's happening now because, you know, thus far we all assumed that we had the same understanding of everything, and in fact we don't. You know, I have the following names in this order: Ms. Schaefer, Ms. Silkstone, Ms. Jeffrey, Ms. Sugarstone. For now.
Mr. Chair, I mean, it is actually proposed in the bill Act 23H&I to make an offence for contravening 43 and 42.
23 which?
H&I.
H&I, 43 and I, okay?
No, 4.
What is
43? 43 is the one with the old virus in theory.
Okay.
Yes, but that requires going to a court of law, doesn't it, Mr. Shepard?
Yeah.
So the fine or the imprisonment is not imposed by the commission.
No. I was just saying that we were looking at, the CDE proposal, and then John was saying maybe it shouldn't actually be made an offence, but it is exactly being proposed that it is. So we must decide then, and just bear in mind when we look at Section 3 if we want to review that.
All right, fair enough. All right. Jeffrey?
No, look, I haven't seen that 4-2 has been taken out. But that's fine, we can look at it. Then does take care of the CGE concern. I think on the broader debate of the functions of the Chapter 9, and you know, the difficulty is the moment you start giving them teeth to penalize, you've got to then ensure that they follow the direct processes. So you use the example of the Competition Commission, which is a tribunal. You've got to ensure that there's legal representation, that everybody can see what is going on, what is being put before them, and you've then got to provide appeal mechanisms. Now, there are no appeal mechanisms from the Chapter 9s because they don't have any teeth. I mean, my understanding of the Chapter 9s, when one looks at the watchdog analogy, is that it isn't a watchdog with teeth. It's a watchdog with a loud bark. And you want to ensure that the bark is as loud as possible. But if you start saying it can bite people, then that's something else. It's going on to another terrain. So you want to ensure that these watchdogs have a loud bark. And then, you know, it would be going access to Parliament, to the National Assembly, whatever, or other bodies, to get that bite. Or as that section that of course, you all Amisa referred to, of going, they're going to court themselves, that kind of thing. But, you know, you've had situations where a former Minister of Justice was very upset because she was held to be a human rights violator. And, you know, she had to be persuaded not to go to court. Not to take a commission on review. But now let's say the commission could have declared her a human rights violation and fined her penalty. I mean, that would have been even worse.
let's take the Patani matter. They made a finding. There's a debate around whether it was not so much appropriate for the value in terms of a finding. But let's say they could make a finding and they could then say, okay, the minister of, because if the undue force was necessary, the minister of police must pay X number of thousands to family. That's inappropriate. That's for the court to do. You know, so that's the difficulty. So to my mind, it's monitoring, assessing compliance even of international treaties. But when it comes to if you haven't done it, it must make a loud noise. It can either be one of these loud dogs that bark very loudly, or one of these yappy dogs, which are almost as effective as a loud barking dog.
And we keep coming back to the point. In Kevin's slow manner, it's so effective. And really, I mean, the guy is phenomenal.
And so we're going to put in reports.
Yes. You know, and he does it quietly, tables his report here in Parliament, has the odd press conference. He's not on TV every day. You don't see him. No, seriously. And you think about it and you say, you know, when his reports appear in the media, goodness, it's frightening. And no one makes a noise or a sound about it. All right. Sorry if I stole your thunder just then.
No, thank you, Chaplain. That is my room. You can't stay in. You know, we traveled to Austria as the standing committee on the Auditor General. And in Austria, we had a discussion with the parliament, with institutions of higher learning, with other bodies of auditor generals. They all praised Nombel, and they said that is the reason why he is the president of the international body of auditors. So I want to agree with what the chairperson is saying. You don't have to be on TV every day. I think what John Deffrey is saying is 100% correct. Let them back. They must make enough noise. But the truth, I think we are the truth. They must table reports to Parliament. And action must be recommended by a committee, unless if we want to agree that we are useless as a portfolio committee on justice. Unless we want to say that. They need to table reports to ourselves. Like the Auditor General tables report to Parliament, and Parliament gives it to the relevant committee. And I haven't seen any committee that does not take the Auditor General's report not seriously. I haven't seen it. Everybody is very serious. Portfolio committees, copper, what have you, everybody is serious about that report. So what needs to happen is that they must make serious recommendations. They must not. I don't know what is smart about being judgmental. When you read the report of the Auditor General, when you read the municipality report, you will always find one thing, that the Auditor General went all out of his way to find the mistake, and all out of his way, which he didn't have to do anyway, to assist, even before he took down his pen to make a report to Parliament, and then said, we have done 1, 2, 3, 4. We think there is hope on this, but here, the Parliament must do something about it. The red lines are red. He even goes to an extent of drawing pictures of red faces, green faces. You know those reports. So I think they've got enough to do. The other thing, what are we going to do? I don't want to be out of Parliament yet. We must have work to do. That is our theory. The writing one is our theory.
Excellent.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. So where are we, Mr. Labiscaffi? Those 4-2 is dealt with.
So I think the scene would be not going to provide for the engine course.
The energy's already there.
Yeah, that's fine. We just may need to look at whether it's adequate. And that's another thing.
Principally, this is just like that.
Okay.
So doesn't then we go to those 5?
Wait a minute. 4-4, honourable members, Mr. Labiscaffi, that's one that was referred to by the CGP's submission.
Can I just tell you, I read the CGE submission and I don't understand.
All right, fine.
So leave with 4-6.
Okay. I couldn't let it go, Mr. Labiscaffi. I had to make reference to it so that at least they could say, well, they did consider our submission, you know.
No, it doesn't, and I'm glad you made that remark, because that's why I would have thought that CGE would be here to elaborate on the submission part. Anyway, we then go to plus 5, sub 1. Now, I know this is going to be a very controversial clause. Maybe we could write for the composition. 11 members must be South African citizens, have a record of commitment to the promotion of respect, human rights, applicable knowledge, be appointed by the President in accordance with Section 193, 4 and 5 of the Constitution. Now, Chairperson, we will remember when I read the briefing, the number of members was questioned, whether 11 is not too much of the need was to it. But anyway, so I think that will be open for a long debate in this committee. And then we're going to...
Yeah. All right, let's start. We need this debate. We've touched on it a few times already. So let's engage on it. Mr. Jeffrey, Ms. Smuts.
Look, we've had the debate a bit, I mean, we've got a 5-person commission. We had 5-person commissions, 1 vacancy, 5 full-time, 2 part-time. The commission themselves from Fenero was stretched, and they were very eager for at least an additional person. I think that was a full-time person. We had my colleague, Mr. Lali Madake, raising, I think, the Canadian experience, where it seems to be sort of like onto small bodies, or it's more staff that do things. Mm. So it may be useful to look at, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, Ms. Cohen was telling me before the meeting that she's been looking at some international comparisons and there's not any, I don't want to put words in mouth, but there's no real common trend. But it may be useful to look at that. I don't know if that can be shared with us. I think what we've got to bear in mind is the cost issue. I mean, this is a commission that is battling to function at the moment. And then we do have, to you, Chair, and Smuts, there was a great enthusiasm at the Chapter 9, when we did Chapter 9. And there are other elements of the report need to still be looked at. But I mean, you've got a commission, culture and politics, you've got the gender commission. And I think that my big fear is that the remuneration of the Chapter 9 is going over to the Remuneration Commission. They tend to be more enthusiastic about remuneration levels than Parliament is. And my fear, I must be honest, is that it has to be there. It's in terms of the Constitution, but they, we might be a little bit shocked with the levels that they're then suggesting commissioners should be remunerated on. Magistrates they've given magistrates huge increases in the past. The magistrates seem to have forgotten that. But really, in short, what I'm saying is it may be not really helping much. I think my gut feeling is 11 is too big. Maybe the existing one, a 5 plus 2, is too small.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, you know, there's always been a preference for odd numbers. I don't think we need to go for, you must have an odd number for a vote, because you can settle that by getting the chair and cast a vote. But anyway, I'm just making, I suppose, general observations.
Alright, so 11 is too much.
I would say 11 is too much, but I'm mindful of the Commission saying that the current 5 plus 2 is too little.
The smuts and then the salsa.
Okay, repeat what I said before and then pick up from what I think Jeffrey is suggesting. To me, there's simply no issue. We don't want to repeat the 11 commissioners created in 1994. That position changed de facto anyway. Because President Mbeki didn't agree to the names we sent up. This is a crisis in itself, but that's not how we have it. I said before that I'm in favour of the 7 that the Tabeline Review suggests. And the suggestion then was, I would have made them 7 full time, but I think, as the Honourable Jeffrey then argued, sometimes you get a really very well qualified people only on the basis of availability part-time, that without, one doesn't wish to mention names, but some of the best qualified people we've got now are part-time because they wouldn't be available full-time. So that is worth bearing in mind. I would tend to go for, I think 5 plus 2 is enough. But now the other thing that the Honourable Jeff has alluded, what's so funny?
Sorry, that's a different issue.
All right, that's fine. That's you my laugh. Now, I think the other thing that Honourable Jeffrey was alluding to is interesting to bring in here. It's this. The proposal in the Chapter 9 review, and it was Carter's, this is Carter's big project, was that the Human Rights Commission, as it then was, because qualified and reasons were so good, the proposal that we all signed up was that Jody and Leon's terms should be prolonged, even if it meant changing the law, that because they were doing so well, that they should become the umbrella. That there are too many other commissions based on rights, when the Human Rights Commission is already the watchdog for all of the Chapter 2 rights. And therefore the argument was, bring in under the umbrella the Cultural and Religious Rights Commission. Bring in even PANSELB, which is not a Chapter 9 body, it's not even an independent body, it's a Section 6 constitutional advisory body, but it's language rights. Bring that in. Bring in the gender. You know, it was always a big argument amongst many of us whether you should separate gender rights from other rights, because you must perpetuate the separation of women. Anyway, most people wanted the separate gender commission, including my party, my view was different. But so the argument is, make an umbrella, bring all these others in under the Human Rights Commission. I still think it's a desirable direction of travel, but the fact is nothing was done. Jody and Leon's terms of office were not prolonged. The whole thing was dependent on that. Now, so I think for us, maybe we should think whether the current Human Rights Commission, I think it is establishing itself, whether it will in another year or so have established itself sufficiently well to become such an umbrella. Then I think it's well worth doing, because we have a lot of commissions, we have a lot of commissioners. The cultural and language arts people in particular, there are very many of them, if memory serves. They are appointed in a way which is frankly not constitutional. That was something that my party, Dr. Del Porto, supported at the time, but I was not happy with it. So I think there really is room for moving in this direction. I think the Honourable Jeffrey's point is good. All he's saying is that we may travel in that direction, therefore don't let appoint dozens of people to each commission, or certainly ones in our hands. And so I'm sympathetic to that. And don't forget, Christine Folkestone in her paper has reminded us that one of the reasons we wanted even 7 was because we wanted an information commissioner, but we have now created an information regulator under a completely different law. The other thing that I think we suggested was a disability commissioner. But you know, I mean, there are lots of human rights. That doesn't mean you need a dozen people. So I would stick with seven. I would make five of them full-time, and on the Honourable Debbie's argument, allow two of them to be part-time. Well, I don't know about this part-time thing. I don't think we're getting... So there you are. That would be my position.
All right.
In the meantime, I may support the position that maybe we have 5+2. Though in terms of the information I've provided...
Sorry, I'm laughing about that.
Oh, well, I thought you were laughing about the 5+2.
I was laughing about this, and you were laughing about this, and you sent me a note about what you were laughing about.
In terms of the information I provided on the best practice travel tour, you know, the truth is that one actually recommending far less number of commissioners as compared to 5+2. Based on the data, the argument is that, you know, when you present the kind of problem that comes out of the top 9 institutions, most of the time it will be centered around governance issues and capacity. And governance is about this whole big contingent of commissions who are not really the good soldiers. And for all intents and purposes, on a day-to-day basis, what's important is who's going to be working. Then there's more need for more experts coming in to do the work. More than just having commissioners who almost are like a boss.
Mm.
What is unfortunate is that we have in the South African, we bring in the Kara as far as possible. We have in South African Human Rights Commission away from CDV. And I think I've said it previously that you know, it might be good to have a way of bringing the two together and indeed to reducing the number of commissioners and yes. Though when it comes to large for an institution, I have to actually put forward my slate. When it comes to many cultural groups, linguistic groups, but when it comes to issues of gender, it's a folly. Because we're not there yet. Going to be boxing it somewhere within a big commission. It's going to disappear. And of course we still have areas like disability and children that really needs dedicated attention, but that does not really have to articulate more commissioners. So I would in the meantime, the reason for support the 5+2. But what is also crucial is to have a way of leading this process. You know, more uniformity and consistency. Have a way of engaging the other structure that goes to the Commissioner of Gender Equality and this FERM and the rest of them.
Jeffrey and Mr. Schaefer?
Look, I think the discussion is useful.
Mm.
I would like to, it's maybe more repeat of what I've said to, I don't know if through you, Chair, to Ms. Cohen, if this international comparison that you've done, whether that's available, can we get that? And then, through Chair, I think we should actually hear from the Commission their views, because they were the ones who were complaining that they are overworked. It would also be linked to, you know, how they're structured and things, but I think that should be, you know, they should be given an opportunity to respond.
I mean, that's like a comparison between this Human Rights Commission and the public. I mean, she does a huge amount of work, seemingly increasing volumes of work, and she's one person. So I do have some concerns as to why they don't have any commission, because, I mean, yeah, you know, the commissioners can be in charge of certain portfolios, but then they need staff to do the work, and I don't see why they can't structure themselves in such a way that they can do that as effectively. So I think that might be quite useful to have here and ask them that kind of thing. Why do they need a commission? Surely their commissioners themselves don't have to go around and do all the work. They have to oversee it ultimately and take ultimate responsibility. But they don't necessarily have to go and do it themselves.
It takes her back, I'll recognize you just enough to see. It takes her back. I clearly recall, I'm not sure if Mr. Lovescuffney was around. It was during Jody and Leon's time. They had a very strong CEO, a strong personality. And he was everywhere. Right? And it got to the point where tensions developed between the CEO and the commissioners. had to say, as a portfolio committee, say to the CEO, the face of the commission is the commissioners. It can't be the CEO. So, fine, you know, we've come some way since then, and maybe there's a time now for us to rethink and reassess and look at why it can't operate in the same way that the public protector does, where it's one person with staff and officers and a CEO. I don't know. You know, you can think about that. I know Ms. Ilana Majake feels very strongly that hers is the Canadian model, Mrs. Cohen.
We should
go to
the phone, by the way. It's a Canadian model which we copied from, by the way, the South African. The problem is the technical problem. The problem is that we are experiencing now the abuse. So they come from there. Then they actually took the other route, which they are saying now is such.
Okay.
So this is something that you can learn from.
Let me hear Ms. Kingsford-Stone first, the Dean, and then Ms. Sachs, and then Mr. Jeffrey.
I'm actually focused on the issue that as I report to the members of the different commissions, and the CRL commission is between 11 and 17, CG is between 7 and 11, and CASA 9, PSC 14, and the SFD was reduced from 22 to 9.
Good.
So it's all
22. Finance and Fiscal Commission.
Yeah.
Wait, Ms. Max, Mr. Jeffrey, and then Ms. Sachs.
No, I mean, I think the issue of the relationship between the commissioners and the CEO is important. We must look at that. I mean, because
yeah, one looks
at the public sector. I mean, it is the public sector, you see, not the CEO.
Sure.
Maybe in space. I think though that one does want the decisions. I think it is. I think the Human Rights Commission is different to the public protector, which is a specific function. This is sort of broader. Would be, and that's also where the commission would need to explain how they work and what they're doing. But we had also been concerned that decisions, reports from the commission must be from the commission, not from the staff. So the staff prepare the report. And so this famous human rights violation matter that I spoke about earlier, I think that was from the staff involved. Okay, Ms. So we had asked that where they are making findings, that those findings must be the findings of the commission.
Okay, just a bit, if I may give some preliminary responses on my side. You see the number that Christine cites, they're absurd. Mm-hmm. The commission was a long name. Was it, what did you say, 17?
Mm-hmm.
Between 11 and 10. It's absurd. I mean, at most you would argue that every language, a culture tends also to have a language. At most you'd say 9 of them. But, and you know, that's for another day. But 17. And the CGE is how many? 7 to 11. Well, it's like the Old Human Rights Commission, obviously. But there, if you look, it has not been the most successful commission. So then, I mean, commentators would, but it's just not necessary. Just to me, the FCC to me is a completely a different animal. It's wonderfully successful, or it was last time I looked. It's very technocratic. I mean, it's just not comparable to these.
Yeah, but you're not saying why there should be that many, 22.
No,
but
they
must be.
I've gotten reduced
to 9.
Yeah. And I forget the reason.
Their success has nothing to do with the numbers of the minute.
But I forget even why it's conducted like that. But it's technocratic. It's not like one of the right commissions, right? Now, I mean, the reason why I think I agree with the Honourable Chairperson. The general point of her argument, why is the public protector have, it's not one, it's two people, and the Human Rights Commission, why should they have so many more? I think it's in the nature of what they're dealing with. The public protector's work is very difficult. It's about maladministration and rudeness the improprieties in the public service. Okay. That's what it's about. Yeah. And then you have a few little extra statutory duties under the Corruption Act. Yeah, but it's really highly technical work that the public protector's office does.
Mm.
And by very nature, she gives herself out to investigators, or each province gives out to investigators. Human rights is by definition different. The chapter 2 encompasses all of the fundamental human rights. It's perfectly logical that you have commissioners who specialize, and the way they divvy it up as a work, as you know, remember from that chapter 2 that they've given us, that they break it up into some of the children's rights and this province, or you know, provincial prisons. I'm not sure how well that works, but each of them has taken a province, and each of them has taken a cluster of rights. For example, the deputy chair here in the Western Cape, she does, what is it called, sanitation and this, that, and the other, and the commissioner we last with, so they give up the rights of it. And just even right by their very nature, each is a huge field. So to me, the comparison between the public protector and this commission has limited use. But the comparison between the others is useful. The cultural language, etc., and they should all be cut down. If I may just say to you, I negotiated the Chapter 9 in both the interim and the final. And the last time I read comparatively must have been around the time of the interim. Now, or between the two. But just to refresh my memory, the Canadian Human Rights Commission is unlike this one completely. It's an equality court. It was the last time I read it.
Okay.
Yes, it's an equality court. It has its scope. The point I last read was specifically the right to equality. It wasn't, and in Canada the fundamental human rights are, what are they called? But they are, you know, nobody's more comparable to us in Canada, constitutionally. And which is why we lean on their constitutional jurisprudence to such a degree also. But their Human Rights Commission, the last time I looked, had a specific limited remit. It was there for equality issues, and it works completely differently. It is something with more of a, or it was, more of a tribunal type of aspect. It's not our kind of human rights commission at all. Has that changed?
The Ontario one.
No, this is provincial. That's a federal state.
It does.
One applies in one
province. That's where the main office for the whole council. It actually is the same thing. The point that I was actually making reference to the what's happening in Canada is about the number of commissioners, how it used to be so many, and why it actually reduced in both commissions. Because they believe that there's more need for capacity in the commissions, and the capacity comes from the expertise that you bring in. When in actual fact, when you appoint commissioners, I don't think we actually also, to some extent, do a balanced appointment in terms of expertise that relates to my position. Yeah. And of course, the argument that Taifa about the public protector, also to some extent, is appropriate. But at the same time, when you look at the situation of the public protector and you look at confusion around public protector and detention, you know, those are some of the things that we need to, even when we are dealing with this act, try and take care of them so that we don't actually. The same would go to the role of the chief executive officer, which is the executive authority. Because there's been so much of fight in these Chapter 9 institutions. And the fight sometimes comes from the legislative framework that governs. you ask a another question?
You must just ignore
a
general.
So the five come from the legislative framework that governs the Chapter 9 institution. And of course, we're still going to come to appointment of the chief executive officer and the staff. And the point I can make before you come to that, when I looked at it, I just said to my mind that when you start talking about chief executive officer, you need to actually say the accounting officer in accordance to the public accounting standards. The main confusion comes from that, because when they are appointed, of course, will be made to feel that they are accounting officers. But when it comes to implementation, sometimes it becomes a problem. But we need the act itself to clearly articulate it so that it does not become a problem.
Okay. All right. I'm allowing this broad discussion because I think it's necessary. Because we've only touched on clause 5, eh?
Yeah,
5-1. Right. And I'm deliberately not pushing it this last couple because these are important points that we needed to pay amongst ourselves and get an understanding of the direction in which we should be moving. So for now, it's 5 plus 2.
Yeah. And may we add one thing? Everyone, but my colleague just raised. I mean, I think it is our everyone's intention to start writing in here, but this one doesn't have because it's the old 1994 Act, that we should have a, if you like, a qualification and a disqualification clause. And all you can really say in the qualification one, apropos what you just said, is that first, eligibility. An eligibility clause, a person eligible for this, now the Constitution already says South African fit and proper. What we want to add is someone who has a track record, a demonstrable record of, it's already in the amending one. Okay. A record of commitment to the promotion of respect for human rights and culture of human rights. Applicable knowledge or appearance. Okay, that's it. Because I don't think you can take it very much further. And then are we going to do, you see, unless you do what the Limajaki has just been suggesting, or were you, but I think it's impossible. You could start saying, you could start enumerating the rights, but you can't name. Then you write this clause 36, 35, almost 35, no, okay, that's all right. But then we need a disqualification clause, just the standard, man, bankrupt,
okay.
Committed, convicted of an offence.
Man, wouldn't you pass?
Mad bankrupt or convicted of an offence, and we use some sort of exception.
How are you going to determine that he or she's mad?
How easy is it to stand the court? But the conviction one is always the more tricky one, because we try to make an exception to people convicted before the transition. Yeah.
Okay. So, Mr. Lavska, what the members are saying is not here.
Mm.
Yeah, look, I think the proposal that this here was five, what we've got at the moment, five plus.
Five permanent and two part-time.
What I'm then asking is if the committee can agree to it, can Ms. Cohen give us the documentation on the international comparisons? And can she report back to the commission as we are thinking of going with keeping the numbers small? And then on the MAD ad, it would be like, I was looking at the section, I don't know if it's covered elsewhere, but it's Section 47 of the Constitution mentioned for the National Assembly, unrehabilitated, insolvent, unfound, mind by life, by court of law, convicted of an offence for more than 12 months, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but although you change that part of the Constitution, which is it could be an MP, you know, you could come to Parliament if you had the same thing as what? Anything? Under 12 months, you can't be coming to Parliament
at all. You can't
be coming to Parliament at all, yeah, that's the number anymore.
But no, actually...
But that's really cool.
See, I don't know how long you're going on for.
That depends on you. I thought initially 1 o'clock.
I'll have to leave, I think, about 4 to 1 o'clock.
All right, well, we'll see how we go.
Okay.
So,
if Because it would be useful, you know, if I don't, can we meet this afternoon, or is that not going to be possible?
Isn't it the treasury?
It's PPC, so
it's PPC, that's why Mr. Jeffrey is asking. Where's my phone? I'd like to hear treasury.
Well, I don't owe that to the finance minister, but I can't have that. Probably
yeah.
After
his
speech,
or maybe after
speech.
I'm guided by you. 2:30.
Are you assuming
whether
you
were
in trouble with the
mission? Well, the understanding is that when there's EPCs, we can meet. Right. It's only when if the program says plenary, you see, then we have to apply the permission. And this afternoon is ETCs. 2:30?
Yeah.
Alright. Are you okay with that? Doesn't it affect you in any way?
It doesn't matter. We'll just have to phone my PA and ask her to choose my
yes. Do that, please, yeah.
Right. Okay. It would be till 4 because we've got
yes.
Even if we are.
Yeah. 2:30 to 4, alright? Okay.
I think Mr. Mindy can tell us if there's a change in the or I don't have time to check on that now.
Try to keep this going, alright?
But Chair, maybe jump forward as it were. I mean, maybe.
How far forward?
No, on 4 or 5.
Okay.
In terms of this issue, and it's just a broader thing relating to. Now,
this provision for which I wasn't aware of, there's a new clause that the term of office of full-time members may not expire simultaneously.
Yes.
It's 2B.
Yeah, I think we must amend
that. I think that's weird. What is here is that what is envisaged is everybody gets appointed one time, and you then do your term, and if you expire, then somebody gets appointed in your place for the remainder of the term, and then you have a new commission again. So that's actually, that's what was envisaged, but there is this provision of not in expiring simultaneously. What's been happening is people come and go, and you do have some kind of continuity, which isn't a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a provision which I find strange that the president may appoint in the event of a vacancy. Now, I was speaking again, sorry Judith, you're going to wish you hadn't spoken to me, just about that. Apparently that came from, and Mr. Lovescott, you may know, that came from Commissioner Colton's time. But you can't. Yeah, I don't think that's appropriate. I mean, even if you look at the SABC board, they all like resigned or got fired or whatever, and then Parliament had to appoint a new board. It's Parliament. So I think that I would have thought then that the provisions it's more or less what we've been doing. That this B around not expiring simultaneously goes, that you get appointed, when you're appointed, for the term here is 7 years, we can debate that, I see the junior commissioner are unhappy because I think they're 5. I don't have a problem with 7. You can be reappointed, can you, or not?
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
I don't have a problem with...
Seven years.
Yeah, but I think also that the term can be shorter. So let's say that this dramatic realignment of commissions is going to take place. You don't want to appoint the people for 7 years and you're stuck with them and things. So it can be for a shorter period.
Mm-hmm.
The vacancy thing, a vacancy isn't for the remainder of the term, it's for a new term.
Okay.
If there's a vacancy. So this person we're appointing for commissioner by, we appoint them for
2 years.
No, not for 2 years.
Oh.
Up to 7 years.
Oh,
right. Why 2 years?
Okay. No, I understand.
Yeah, and then the thing of appointing acting commissioners, that should go. The only one would be whether the what provision I saw that the president could appoint a part-time person later if there's a vacancy on the full-time. The president could appoint
somebody.
Yeah, could appoint the part-time for the full-time.
Even your friend in 5.1d, be appointed by the president in accordance with section 193. Now, it's not that it's wrong, but it's not that. Be appointed by the president on the recommendation of the National Assembly. Because people get terribly confused by this thing. The president appoints only because we don't have any executive capacity. And when he appoints on the recommendation of, or on the advice of, as with most judges, for example, only the sign on the dotted line, he has no discretion. So just to make that clear, let's say in 5.1d, be appointed by the president on the recommendation or the advice, whichever one we use.
That's what's in the Constitution.
Yes. No, but you just insert those words.
Yes.
Be appointed by the president.
Point is,
is it recommendation or advice? Recommendation. On the recommendation,
on the recommendation of the National Assembly must appoint.
Yes. We have our discretion.
Yes.
Correct. What I'm saying, you're saying here, be appointed by the president on the recommendation of the National Assembly in accordance with section 193, 4 and 5. In other words, I promise you all will think this means president and future.
I don't think it's a new because although that's a new thing, it's a really favorite thing for us in the future. But those words of the committee can be made at the later stage to be considered.
What's the problem? Why aren't we putting on the recommendation of the National
Council? No,
a little bit back, but there's no merit in maybe considering different numbers depending on whether they're full-time or part-time. So we say it must be like 7 full-time people or 9, you know, or 7 full-time and 2
full-time. 5 full-time.
No, but what if you want 6 full-time?
Oh,
instead of 5, you
know.
Oh,
right.
My understanding here was that we are still deliberating on this matter. It's a sort of proposal on the table because we want to see Judith's document, what we want to hear from the Commission. But the proposal on the table at this point is quite
for now.
Well,
no,
let me
just consider whether we want to say an applicability for saying out of 6 full-time or 5 part-time.
Something like that.
Well, I can
think about that.
Yeah,
no. But what's the chance? In 2A, it's not the President that determines the term. I mean, we've got to start cleaning this stuff up because you know it all went haywire in the bill and the laws written for other commissions. They started doing things that were just crazy. So the members referred to in someone that they appointed full-time or part-time or all of them for such fixed terms as the president may determine. The president can't determine it because we, in exercising our minds on which people should be appointed, will be looking at the range of expertise we're putting in there, and it's therefore quite important for us to say, unless we have only one simple fixed term for the whole lot, which is maybe where we're going. But can we just get the idea out here that the president determines anything at all, and especially the ones already referred to where the president appoints a part-time or puts in, where is it? Where the president...
It's in 2A.
Okay, now that's the one I'm talking about, there's another one I thought. All right, sorry, yes. But it's not such a fixed term as the president may determine.
Yes.
We are going to determine the office right here in the floor, huh?
Ms. Adams?
Chairperson 2B, if this is for the purposes of continuity, then I think we might have to think about something else, because what do we do if all the commissioners resign at the same time? Then we cannot... we obviously then have to appoint new commissioners, and then we cannot say, well, you're going to be appointed this month and the other one next month, just for the sake of continuity. Because in any event, we never know when somebody is going to resign. But I just think if we need to also think about that.
Yeah. The 3 I was suggesting 1B get leave.
1B.
Sorry, 2B get
leave. Yes,
2B gets
leave.
Yeah,
but what do we do if all the commissioners...
Well, then you've got to appoint a new commission.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's nothing to do with
the
IPSAP report.
But it was a nice idea. The reason that we're in the standard review is because the entire SA Human Rights Commission expired from what they investigated. And that was the very one that we wanted to go on and put on an umbrella. But it's a nice idea, but it doesn't work. And in ICASA, we have to stagger the service for the same reason, so that institutional memory is not lost. But it was a disaster because the names of the two people who had to expire were drawn by lot, and we lost the two best counselors through the random drawing of lots. It was a disaster. Mm. So let's abandon the whole idea.
Can I move on?
Yes.
Okay, now this is, I'm looking at 8. I mean, I think obviously in 5 goes, we do need to specify the thing under, I don't know if it's under 6 or 7, I'm not quite sure what those were, but you do need to specify that you can be reappointed. I think that's somewhere there. Yes. It's not that there be part-time president appointed. We don't want the position that is at the moment that vacancies get filled by Parliament. That is the case I think for the other chapter. I was just wanting to deal with 8B.
Wait, before you go here, there's two things here. 6, sub 6, firstly, where a person may act as an acting member. Don't want that. Okay, so that comes out.
That is what I understood it had come from when I was asking Ms. Cohen. It came from the Metropolitan Times. And he was no longer sort of pushing it anymore.
And then, secondly, I'm just throwing this at you. CGE is saying, I need to read this because I tend to find it somewhat hilarious. CGE Act allows for commissioners to be appointed for a fixed term of 5 years. It is unconstitutional where another human rights institution established in terms of Chapter 9 of the Constitution is treated differently. I mean, well.
Okay, girls.
Yeah, do we ignore that? All right, would you ignore his plans? We're considering their submission. No. Consider rejected. We didn't ignore it.
The benefit is adding 5, 6, 7 because that deals with the acting commissioner.
5, 6, and 7. All right, fine.
I've already made it, but just to come back to Ms. Smoss's idea, 2A. So, is the idea then that the members are appointed for a fixed term? So,
as the National Assembly made it.
But you see, my problem is I don't think, do you think the Constitution allows the Assembly to make recommendations on the term?
I would have suggested a maximum of 7, so it doesn't have to be 7, because we could find out that the grand collapse is going to come of all the chapter 9 is going to come in 4 years time, and therefore we're appointing people for 4 years.
Okay.
So we have it as a maximum.
And that will take care of the gathering of the police.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, 7.
For a maximum of 7 years.
Then, Chair, maybe 8.
Are you happy, Mr. Laskarni?
Well, because at the moment it already provides that for a period not exceeding 7 years.
Yeah, not exceeding.
So I think that will cover the issue.
Where have you got it?
Yes, but it doesn't exceed.
No, we're going to delete that.
Yeah.
So
where's your not exceeding 7 years?
It's 2A.
Not exceeding is candidates.
Well,
yes.
That's what it says, essentially. It can be less than 7.
Now, can I move to 8?
There's a lot of scaffolding. Can we do that? Right. Are you there?
The distinction with the period is that the maximum period is 10 years. It can be less. So it's a question of the wording of the possibility for that. The tier then with 8, look, there's this 3 calendar months written notice for resignation. That's good in theory, but if you've got like, and I know you've got there that the National Assembly can by resolution allow a shorter period. But my difficulty often is, you know, you've had a major fight in the Commission. You can't stand the sight of your colleagues. You want to go now. You know, why can't you stop laughing?
It's happened.
No views are
that. No major fights has happened?
A while ago. But anyway, so is this 8A is nice in theory, but is it practical?
Mm.
I think the same is there for the FABC board, but there has to be notice. Maybe it's covered by the National Assembly can by resolution allow a shorter period, but I'm just highlighting that as a concern. Then under B, my worry is you've collapsed two issues. B1 is, okay, if you accept nomination for the NA or the NCOP or provincial legislature or municipal council, you must go, which would take care of problems that did occur with another commission sometime before, and then appointed as an office bearer of a political party. Okay, those are fine. But then my difficulty is number 3.
Mm-hmm.
You put is an office bearer of a party. So a member is regarded as having resigned if that member is appointed as an office bearer or they are an office bearer. I think 3 must go under the restriction section.
Yeah.
So you can't be appointed
if you're an office bearer
or a member of the National Assembly or the NCOP. You can accept nomination as member of the Human Rights Commission, but you must obviously then resign before you're appointed. As if you look at the case of I think Commissioner Love.
Yeah.
Was a member of the AEC and then resigned. So I think that was fine. You want them to resign, like, you know, a certain councillor from your party who now you don't want to say to the poor guy, look, you've been nominated, you must resign. Maybe we should do that. But you don't, it's not actually really that fair. He must only resign if he gets appointed.
Yeah, I think that's fair to you.
Look, it's the NEC position which now become entrenched in law. The DP position, always was. If you're appointed to say, then you hang away from the extent that you're not in the DP. Alternatively, opposition of officer, you must have a cool-off period of 1 or 2 years. You can't go from the benches to the so there's always been the structure of life. But the NEC position has now made itself into any number of laws. It's also understand the number of years. That in our nation's democracy, which is the phrase you guys always use on everyone. Our nation democracy. All the good people were anyway politically active, so therefore, you have to say. They can become independent people as long as they resign from being political people. So that's the, you know, it's the position of the
government. And I should be independent.
Absolutely. Anyway, I agree to take care of the eligibility and responsibility.
Okay.
The oath, the Roman reading must form part of the new post that we put in.
Yes, that disqualifies you. So how does that all affect C? Should we leave that to Mr. Lambscaffold to work out?
Yeah, you know, commissioners take appropriate steps where you don't give the 3-month notice to stay.
All right, fine.
Yeah, and what one of the steps, you know, you're fired.
Pay the salary back.
We call the pension.
I don't want to get a pension.
I don't know how that provision, how it will be applied in practice, but apparently it has been said that here in Guelph a similar problem that was experienced previously in respect of one of the other police officers. Yeah, that's why they have been said that in Guelph. But that was perhaps Mr. Selecka, because he's from our constitutional development, you know, perhaps he can. I don't want to mention any names of the commission, but
why not?
You might have to.
It was.
Is this the CDE? The first accepted nomination? No.
I'm not sure because this recommendation came from B unit.
Which floor
is it? This is
C.
Where if notice is not given, then the commission can take steps to recover some of the remuneration of the person. But as I said, I don't know how it's going to be implemented in practice.
So, if the person is
yeah.
Do they have the right to recover?
Yeah, that's fine.
That's fine.
Yeah. I wasn't saying anything specific on the 3 months. I was just worried about the practicality of
yeah.
it. You have dealt with put in a flexibility with the NA determining a shorter period. You do want to protect against the thing. And I think I vaguely seem to remember that you know, somebody did resign and it was only discovered much later, I think by the relevant commission. I can't remember was it gender or this person. The person had gone to resign and they've been like changed or something.
Mr. Shepherd, I want to close.
Okay.
Yeah.
If a commission of 7 people can't figure out this person has left and continues to pay their salary, they don't deserve to get paid.
Well, it cannot pay me.
You know,
depends what can do. It can't be. It's for a week, and must pay for it. One other thing very important about this legislation is how to lodge.
How do you lie to?
Who do you invite to? How do you lodge that letter of resignation?
Okay.
It must be clearly articulated.
It's an important point, Mr. Lovisco.
I see this quickly. I'm not trying to
just. Should you resign the National Assembly? Or
yes, you should resign
the
National
Assembly.
No. To the National Assembly.
Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. We don't have any existence here. So things like appointments. The resignation thing goes to the
speaker. It's a pity that the institution is protecting whatever are not here, because yes, that is a problem, and it you know, I heard the state law advisors saying it has to be a double pass, sorry, that it has to be the person who resigns, the person appointed you, which
yeah.
makes sense.
Yes,
but you know, the problem is going to be we had a delay
yes, we did.
with the appointment of. Let's say, the deputy public sector. Everybody knew the term of office was expiring. But Parliament or the National Assembly couldn't on its own start
initiate.
It had to have a letter from the Minister
yes,
of Justice. And you know, is that necessary? Can we find a way of avoiding that? But I do think it needs to be specified in the bill. Who do you resign to? It has to be the president.
No, can't you say let us resign to the president and table appeal that notes the letter of resignation to the National Assembly?
National Assembly. That's one way of doing it, Mr. Lovisco. You must resign to the president, and we say in the legislation, one must resign to the president, and the president must table the resignation in the National Assembly.
Chair, what about the Speaker's office?
About the Speaker's office.
Why not lodge in the Speaker's office?
No, it's appointed by the president. No. He's appointed by the president on the recommendation of the National Assembly.
Yes.
So you resign to the president. When the president receives your resignation, he or she tables it in the National Assembly.
Well, I'm worried about logistics around that.
What about the logistics?
The length of appeal
that
they
tell
you. What length of appeal? Well, never mind. There's what you can do in the statute and what you can do is what you
can do. But something
that's critical. No, you deal with the rest.
Are you saying the president will hold it back?
Yes. Of course.
I'll be putting this letter and
affecting
it to me. Yes. In Parliament in time.
In time for what?
For the National Assembly.
There's no time. You resign to the president, and that's it. You resign.
Go on.
You're gone. Bye-bye. What time? Yes. No. It's tabled here because we must be informed you've resigned,
And then obviously there are processes that follow that will reappoint them.
My point was, I mean, the point that we had that John raised was that we didn't always know in time.
Yes.
So my suggestion was that the person resigning table a copy with us and made that trigger to the speaker. And then send it to the prison and send a copy to the speaker's office, maybe. Because then at least we know at the same time it comes here. Because we've all
heard
of
the speaker's
office.
Yeah.
No,
all
you can say
is
exactly
the way you just said it. The prisoner then must turn up. And after the deal with the actual process after that.
If something is tabled, that's a legal process,
a
formal legal thing. And tabling it means that people must be informed about it. It doesn't sit in someone's ink tray for 3 months.
It goes into the
ATC, and the ATC says, Commissioner so-and-so has resigned. That's what tabling means. All right.
Same venue
here. 2:30 here.